It's just past 18 hours, 32 minutes and 56 seconds, East African time. Time for John Sebiokumu on Wednesday. This being Wednesday, the 31st of May, 2023. Hamjambo na karibuni. Hello and welcome. Today's today, but tomorrow will be the 1st of June. For Kenyans, it will be Madaraka Day, a day first declared in 1963, that is, 60 years ago. Which begs the question, how many relatively young Kenyans appreciate its significance? Je, siku ya Madaraka ina umuhimu gani kwako? Here are some indicative answers.
Yes, Madaraka Day has a lot of importance to me because it is my birthday.
I don't think it has to me directly. So there's no benefit I get.
I don't find it significant because I've never benefited from it.
It doesn't have any impact to me because I'm not the one who's been celebrated, neither of my family. That day, at least my mind gets to rest because during the week, maybe you started week or maybe on a different note. So at least that day you'll have to reschedule yourself.
Because I've never benefited from it since the celebration started.
Ndio mwanzo ya wale wasilishi katika nchi yetu ya Kenya wakati tulipata jamhuri.
Dada, comment please on what you've heard.
Well, firstly, a happy birthday to whoever celebrating tomorrow. But I find that quite sad that so many young people feel that Madaraka Day has no impact on their lives.
Yes, I tend to agree, Dada. But you and I are of a certain age. I'll tell you where I was on Madaraka Day 1963. I was a youngster. I dare say I was I should have been maybe 9 or so. And I would have been walking the streets of London because my dad had gone to England to study, and we were to return just in time for independence in 1964. So I'll put the question to you. Where were you? Like, you know how they say when there was a moon landing or something. Where were you, Dad, on Madaraka Day?
I was a carefree 12-year-old walking to school at Kilimani Primary School. We lived nearby, and that's where I went to primary school.
Gosh, okay. Then and now, Kilimani. The first question that I'm going to ask you, and there's going to be a tie-in at the end of our conversation, is what was Kilimani School like then? Again, let's share. When I came back from the UK, circumstances conspired to have me go to what was then Mathega Primary School. And Mathega Primary School, right next to the Mathega Club, was apart from my sister and me, it was an all-white school. In 1964-65. What about Kilimani?
Well, I left Kilimani at the end of 63, but I think there were very, very few black Kenyans there at the time.
Mm. And what, yes. What about, let's go back to the other race then. Were there any South Asians, as we are to address them these days?
Again, a handful.
A handful.
But very few.
So talk to me, was it, because we're going back and down memory lane, what was Kilimani Primary School for you then in the early 60s?
Well, first, I have to say I hated school.
Oh, dear.
I didn't want to be at school, but I have lifelong friends from that school to this day, many of whom still live here.
Okay, so in terms of curriculum, I mean, what childhood has things that we always sort of remember. I remember always being urged, because I had a good speaking voice, I remember being urged to recite things. What was happening to you that you hated school so much? You were being whipped every morning?
No, I wasn't whipped. I was simply a home girl and I wanted to be at home. It was nothing to do with the school that I disliked it. But I too had elocution lessons.
Yes, yes.
The friendly car wall red and white. I love with all my heart. I can remember to this day the lady who taught me.
Yes, yes, indeed. There was an institution then. We have to draw people into this conversation. But at the Kenya Conservatoire of Music, there were elocution lessons. And being the brown-eyed favorite of my head mistress, Ms. June Parker, the late must be now, she arranged for me to go for elocution lessons. So we're hovering around 1963, 1964. Dada, where were you on Independence Day? Do you have any memory of that?
I remember being very upset that my parents wouldn't let me go to the actual celebration, the handing over, which was just beside the Carnival Hotel now. And they didn't think it was safe for me then, I guess, age 13, to go to those celebrations. But they themselves went and came back to tell us all about it the next morning.
Well, we must remember that Madaraka Day is always, if you sort of Google it, the day when Kenya attained internal self-rule in the build-up to independence itself. Mm-hmm. So I guess an academic historian would describe it differently, but it must have been after much negotiation, places like Lancaster House in London, where they sort of gave us the opportunity to have a go with Jomo Kenyatta as Prime Minister. Said, you have a go. For the next 6 months, see whether you can inhabit these offices latterly taken in by colonial administrators. And then, it seems a bit rushed, but I'll go for my PhD in history. But 6 months later, they said, right, now you're on your own. And Jomo Kenyatta became president on December the 12th, 1963. And Kenya remained within the Commonwealth, although the Queen was no longer head of state. But we're not here to discuss history. Let's go back to our own memory. So there you are. You've missed out on Jamhuri Day. Again, childhood memories. If you were to write a memoir now, and you doubtless, are you a grandma?
I am indeed.
Well, what would you tell your grandchildren about those dinosaur days in which we existed?
They probably get sick of hearing me talk about them, actually, because I have such happy memories of my childhood here. And I think it's their memories to be treasured. Our lives were very carefree.
Do share some.
I don't think I ever thought that we were either rich or poor.
Right.
We always had enough, but I never considered us rich. I have memories of going off on a bicycle with my brother and sister, and we didn't come home for hours and hours, and there was no concern for my parents.
So the whole idea of, yes, that's a change in life, because the idea is that as parents, one is to be fearful of a child exiting, because they're all going to meet a bunch of nasties and awful things might happen to them, and molestation and the like. And I dare say I remember the same, that there was no fear of the adult world. So I'd like to ask you, Dada, again, it's the classic sort of ask a white Kenyan question. And that is, when did your family first get here? And when did you decide to become Kenyan? Because, of course, there was a great exodus. We're leaving this place. Chaos is going to ensue. What about your particular case?
Well, my family came in 1903.
Oh, dear.
Okay. Way back.
way back, 1903. Okay, got it. Doing my maths in my head.
Yeah, that was my great-grandfather and his family. My grandfather actually followed in 1906, followed by his fiancée in 08. They hadn't seen each other for 2 years. She arrived by boat, and he met her in Mombasa and said, "We're getting married this afternoon."
Oh, gosh, how romantic. Yeah.
Well, she exclaimed, "No, no, no, I have to unpack my trousseau." So they got married the next day.
Okay.
He then took her up to Limuru.
Right.
Where he lived, I think into a mud and wattle house. And she never returned home to Britain for 15 years.
Okay.
They lived there on a tea farm. In fact, it wasn't tea when she first got there, but a visitor from India went to visit grandfather, said, "This is the right sort of climate for tea," and sent him tea seeds from India, which he planted. They germinated, they grew, and did extremely well. So he sort of started the tea industry in Limuru. I believe there was tea growing there before. But as a commercial crop, he started the original tea farm.
Right. Gosh, history's unfolding, but the dictates of our scheduling means that we have our first break. Thank you very much. Dada, unless we haven't lost our drift, we were into a pioneer in commercial tea farming. And if I heard you correctly, your forebears were in Limuru.
That's right, they were.
Continue, because I want to find out where you come into the picture and what they did.
Well, my grandfather and granny had four daughters. And they brought a governess out from England to teach their girls, whereupon neighbours said, "Oh, can our children come too?" And this led to the start of Limuru Girls' School. Grandfather hived off a little bit of his farm, built a chapel and some classrooms, and so began Limuru. It was actually it was Limuru School, because there were some boys who attended in the early days.
Ah, okay. So you're aware of the fact. Might you have been one of the thousands who attended the 100th anniversary of Limuru Girls? Would it be a week or so ago?
I was there.
You were there?
I was. In the biggest marquee I've ever seen.
Okay.
Yes.
So you... Limuru Girls. Now, okay, now there's an interest in you because you've got to name names now. What were, if they're looking through the history books, what were their names? You were Nay, you were born whom?
Dodds was my surname.
Right.
But my
was it Dodds who set up the school?
No, because it was my mother's parents,
right,
who started the school, and their name was MacDonnell.
Ah,
A.B. MacDonnell and his wife Agnes.
Oh goodness, and you were small detail. Very many girls, beautiful girls, went to Limuru Girls. My wife among them. So there's a link there. I would like to know when. If you yourself went to Limuru Girls.
I did. I went to Limuru in 1964, and I completed my 6 years of the O-level and A-level, because we were following the Cambridge system at
that
stage.
There'll be an interest there, Dada. Did you have houses?
We did.
So, okay, go for that. Which house?
They were named after the headmistresses. So we had Rosevere, Lister, Waller, and Sutton. And I was in Waller, of course, the best.
Okay, but We all say that. That we're going to find linkages yet. What were the sort of, you're there in a girls' boarding school. Was there bullying?
Very little. I can remember being shoved into a cupboard and it was shut on me. Yeah. But it was really very minor, the bullying.
Okay, so is the takeaway that, you know, girls have an easy time of it in life? Because I went to a boys' boarding school and I would say euphemistically that there was quite a bit of bullying.
I think we get away with it lightly.
Right.
And I think to this day there is more bullying in boys' schools than girls.
So
unless the girls keep quiet about it.
Right. And so were you longing in those tea-surrounded fields, waiting for an encounter with boys, and who were your favourites?
Oh, that's a very telling.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, why not?
I will tell you there were many holes in the hedge. Okay. In those years,
mm-hmm.
And there was wattle,
right?
A wattle forest outside the hedge.
So
we
escape.
Did sneak out.
Yes.
And we usually met boys from the Duke of York.
Ah, another link between us. I went to Duco. It's becoming apparent that there are historically there are 3 years between us because. I was at the Duke of York, today's Lenana, from 1967 to 1972, and I was in the best house of all, and that was Speak.
I might agree with you on that one.
Because there was a charming young man from...
There were several special men in the Duke of York.
Yes, the thing is that there we were, close to the railway line, and that we're, you know, life's degenerates. Because far from the madding crowd, there were bad things that were against the rules that we indulged in regularly and frequently. Those of us who would. I was a sort of goody-goody who never transgressed in any significant fashion. But yes, Block 3, Speak and Lugard. I was just wondering, Dada, what you think now about the education that you had, because I'm sure very many people listening to us are sort of like, you know, threatening to spit into their dinner plates because, you know, all this privilege. Have you come to terms with the fact that you were leading a life that was so estranged from the great mass of the populace?
Yes, indeed, we were very, very privileged.
And I mean, does that give you sleepless nights? I mean, are you a philosopher or a thinker, or you just say that's the way it was and, you know, tough?
I think that is the way it was. My parents really didn't have much choice as to where I was to go to school. And particularly with my connections with Lemuru, of course, I had to go there.
Right.
Grandfather would have been very upset if I hadn't.
Right. So I'm interested in terms of young people listening about the demarcations of Nairobi. When you as a family decided to, first of all, when was the decision made as a family that you might become Kenyan? Talk us through that and your memory as a young child.
Well, I do remember it was shortly after independence when a number of Europeans were leaving. A lot of Europeans were leaving. My parents sat us down and said, we are staying here. We want to buy some land. We want to build a home. And we've all got to tighten our belts. And we're not having any fancy holidays because we're going to build a home. And they set about looking for a property, a plot to buy in and around Nairobi. And they found one on what was St. Austin's Road. Now James Gichuru,
right, St. Austin's, yes, you're quite right. And there was sort of St. Austin's Bakery, St. Austin's Butchery, St. Austin's this and that.
Yes,
right.
But the plot we found, they decided was actually a bit too isolated because there was virtually nothing in that area. So we bought a plot on a Dagoretti corner.
Right.
Just on the Naivasha Road.
Yes.
And from my bedroom, which was a sort of attic room upstairs, I looked onto just a green field. It was a very quiet road. There were no buildings there.
Out of nostalgia, have you gone back? I mean, most people sort of go, if I was, I would like to go back to, you know, 47 Carisfort Road in London, in North London, and see whether our dingy little flat still exists. Have you had cause to go back to where you used to live?
I went back there a few months ago.
Right.
It was heartbreaking.
What did you see? What has it become?
It's become a bar.
Oh, well, yes. Something to become. A den of iniquity.
I think so.
Yes.
Yes, our sitting room is now the bar.
Ah.
And our garden is the eating area.
Well, yes. Yeah, we move on.
It's being enjoyed by many.
Yes,
let's put it that way.
Indeed. Okay, so there's also a significant question there, because we've dealt about high school then. Was there, because we're interested in the idea of transition, even as we reminisce very directly about our own lives, do you see a change, for example, in the racial mix of when did you start becoming aware and interacting directly with black and South Asian Kenyans in ways that weren't, you know, like master-servant and then, you know, shopkeeper down the road, the Dukawala. Did that ever, were you conscious of that and when that happened?
I think it just happened very naturally. Because I left after school, I went to England for a short while, as short as I could possibly make it.
Right. So again, I'm getting all mixed up. I'm getting all mixed up, because then there you are going. When you go to England, you are having, again, where there's a sort of living at cross purposes there. I, as a young boy, am being tossed into the streets of London and being quite bewildered by it until I sort of learnt how to speak the language. And you, as a young girl in your teens, are going to the metropolis, you're going to Nirvana, you're going to the land of your grandparents, and you're saying you were disappointed and wanted to come back. So what was disappointing in it, Dada? What didn't sort of tap up?
Well, I went there to nurse,
hmm,
because that had been my dream. And having started my nursing, I ended up as the patient rather than the nurse. But in fairness, I was desperately homesick for sunshine, for bright colours, and I think for Kenya, just to be home. But it was while I was there that I started connecting with another Kenyan girl, an Ethiopian girl, and I think I suddenly realised I had so much in common with these girls who had black skin. But their hearts and my hearts were the same.
You know,
so perhaps that's where it began, that sort of...
The transformation. You know, the sort of given, which is the commonplace, is to say, these Wazungu, you know, the only thing that they're interested in is, you know, the wide open spaces, the Maasai Mara, the animals. They aren't interested in the people. Is that a reflection of, unfair question. Of course you're going to say no. But would you comment on that? I mean, is the allure of Kenya nature and beasts alone?
Sadly, I think for some it is.
Hmm.
I do. I think there are Europeans who live in bubbles here, love the country, the scenery, the wildlife, possibly don't engage with the Kenyan people. I like to think I do, and I love that. I love people.
Right. Well, that could be a segue into a next section of our conversation. But we've got our 2 minutes rolling, and we've got to be very kind to them. I'm going to ask you the question about when you did come back, before we go into the thing, what did you choose to do? Because you said you were going to be a nurse, but now you're not going to be one. So what did you do next?
Well, in England, I had done a secretarial course, really long enough to work there to earn my passage home. I had fun once I had a ticket in my hand, because the end was in sight. I came back and I worked as a secretary here. The old steakhouse. Do you remember, remember that?
Yeah, I do. Yes. So what did you were sort of making, you know, steak tartares and stuff.
No, they kept me well out of the kitchen.
Right.
I've never been great in the kitchen.
Right.
Now, I was helping to set up, actually, the beef house, which was a franchise down in the industrial area.
Right. Brilliant. Time for another break. Thank you very much.
The best mix of music, Capital FM.
Dada, let's go back. Let's stay in sort of introspective intellectual mode a wee bit and sort of say, okay, if you're going to be a rep, in what way would you say that your life has been indicative of public service? Is that an unfair question? I mean, what have you done for the... I could say I've been a broadcaster talking to the Kenyan masses on a daily basis. What would you say?
Ooh. I've run a few little businesses. They've all been very small. The moment they've got big, I've sold them because I never wanted anything very big. And in that, employed a number of people. I've been involved in charities, still am. Part of the East African Women's League, which has been running for, I think it's 105, 106 years now, set up to help women and children in this country. And it's been an exciting time helping through those sort of organisations. I don't know. I'm not quite sure how much detail you want me to go into what I do.
I'll tell you, Dada, there's one thing which is, it's not sort of the psychologist's couch or anything like that. I think that, you know, my point of departure is that our audience is quintessentially young. And the thing about young people is that they, unless they're told about the past, they don't necessarily have cause to know anything about it. So I would just go back and go into the details. Now, if you talk to me and said East African Women's League, I have a calendar or a sort of art book. It seems to have, which I collected in, because I collect such coffee table things, and they seem to have pictures of people embroidering things. So I'd say to myself, the East African Women's League is something like the Rotary Club, correct?
No.
Oh, right. Well,
having said that, I don't know too much about the Rotary Club.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what I do know about the, what my sort of go-to prescription is that these are philanthropically minded individuals who get together and raise money to make the world a better world.
Right. Then I stand corrected. Okay. Then we're very similar. Yes.
Right. So yes. The East African Women's League started 106 years ago, as you've said.
I think so. I think it was 1917.
Mm.
And I know exactly the book you're talking about.
Yes.
And it has wonderful tapestries in it.
Exactly.
Tapestries embroidered by the various branches to depict the area in which they existed. And recently, 2 or 3 months ago, a group from the Women's League, I think there were 70 of us, visited the Houses of Parliament to see the tapestries which hang there. And we were acknowledged by the Speaker in the House. It was just the most wonderful afternoon. We had an amazing time and saw all these tapestries still on display.
In State House?
In Parliament.
In Parliament. Okay, because you got me confused a wee bit there. Sorry. Because I sort of see Joy Adamson paintings in State House, and perhaps they shouldn't be there. The TV cameras seem to catch a bunch of tusks. I said, "Ooh, ivory," but it is State House, but nobody's questioned that. So you're saying there are some very harmless, lovely tapestries done by members of the East African Women's League in Parliament buildings.
Yes, yes, they're displayed there. Everybody walks past them.
Right.
Sadly, some of them have got faded because the sun comes in.
Yes.
I'm happy to say the Karen Nangata one doesn't.
Right.
Because that's my branch. But amazing. And it was wonderful to hear the speaker relay to the House a little bit about our history.
Right.
And how we started out.
My bugbear topic, I'm going to talk about race relations. Again, sorry, Dada, is this league, this Women's League, an all-white enclave?
I would say when it started, most certainly. And more, it is multiracial. I'm on the executive, and we see more and more applications, people joining, and it's very exciting to see lots and lots of Kenyans joining, many Asians. It's very multiracial now, which is wonderful.
Right. Again, I'm going to hit you with my commonplaces. I'm seeing you as my white sister. Went to the same school as my wife. We're all, wonderful relationship is building up here. And I would say for other things that sort of conjured up by a white Kenyan, things like a love of horses, the preservation of wildlife, the rhino charge. Have you been involved in such activity and why? Because I'm going to set you up for later. I've got to set you up for later. Otherwise, people say, "Oh, he's being very unkind to his guest today. What's wrong with?" I'm going to ask you a bit later on whether there are initiatives that have involved you as an individual. I'm asking you to be a spokesperson for the race, which is a bit unfair. Are you a horsey person? Are you a rhino chargy person? And why?
I'd say yes to both. I am a horsey person. Actually, that's not true. My daughter is a very horsey person.
Right.
She rode for Kenya. Mm-hmm. She actually won the world championships, and I can brag about it because I'm her mother.
Right, do.
In the horse world, they always kept me to the catering side and said, please don't get involved with the actual horses.
Dada, did you, if I were to come to your house, are you on a sort of sprawling horses walking around in preparation for the next Ngong race?
No. When my daughter lived there, we had show jumpers. She had show jumping horses. Sadly, she has moved away down to Zimbabwe, so no, we don't have horses on the property now.
Right. So please go back. I cut you short. Do forgive me. What role did you have in the horsey world? And again, I'm going to be a bit niggly, of what social benefit was it? You're free to enjoy yourself. I'm, busy eating my nyama, choma and ugali. Is it the same sort of activity for you? Was it like that? Or did you give all the money away? Or did the... What's happening here?
I think the Horse Association, the money raised, was put back into any sort of equestrian events.
Mm-hmm.
And there were very few Kenyans taking part in early days, but it's grown, and the more and more there are Kenyans now competing. I met someone the other day whose niece was riding in Spain for Kenya on show jumping, and I hope very much I can introduce her to my daughter, which is next here. So I think it is rather an elite sport. It costs money to have horses, but it's lovely to see up-and-coming young Kenyans taking part and enjoying it.
Again, white Kenyans and sport, I'm seeing... Have we exhausted the rhino charge?
We haven't touched on the rhino charge yet.
Do you have any association with that particular?
Yes, through our church, we ran one of the guard posts for well over 20 years. An amazing organisation started by a term I hate, but Kenyan cowboys who... I don't know how much you know about the rhino charge, but it is entirely raise money.
I'm going to, for the benefit of our, I probably do, but the wider public to whom we are speaking in this little studio, do explain in detail. Next time we hear rhino charge, it should conjure up what aims and ambitions.
Right. It's a crazy event. There are, I think it's limited to 65 competitors who start at various points around a course. And in the course of a day or 10 hours, they have to visit every control point in the shortest possible distance. And that means winching yourself down cliffs. It's unbelievable what they achieve. But the biggest aim is to raise money, which initially was to fence off the Aberdare Forest, which is the water catchment for the Nairobi area. And they have succeeded in fencing the Aberdares to protect people from the wildlife and vice versa, and to protect the forest. And I believe... I'm told that on Google Maps now you can see a very distinct line where the forest is fenced, and it's a real success story. They have gone on over the years to raise money, again, for fencing other areas. Mount Kenya they're doing, Iburu, I believe, part of the Mau. And when they run this, the fees collected from... the entrance, people, spectators, all that money is given to the community. But rather than give in cash, they will in advance decide what's needed, be it a borehole, classrooms, a medical centre, whatever it is that's needed. And they will then, after the event, go back and put in whatever they promised. So they don't promise what they can't provide, and they fulfill their word and go back and help. So it's a real win-win, apart from a lot of fun.
Right. On this, the same front, before we finish this particular segment, I'm going to think about sports again, harking back to my own, and you've talked about your children, the idea of sports like hockey, tennis. Again, I remember membership or quasi-membership through friends of the Impala Club, the Nairobi Club, and playing hockey every... Has that been part of your life? Having been inculcated, I presume, at school?
Definitely. Tennis particularly. Hmm. Tennis was always mine. At Lamuru Girls' School, we used to play before breakfast in the mist.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. And it was jolly cold, but yes. It was fun.
Right.
My father was actually a tennis coach.
Right.
And coached the likes of Paul Wekesa in the early days.
Yes,
so
who played for Kenya and was ranked 100 and something in the world.
Yes,
of which we had cause to be proud.
Absolutely, right. A great celebration.
Right.
Yes. So tennis has been a big.
And are you being humble? You've just said Dad was a coach. Were you sort of like Kenya's number one? You're not going to tell me.
No, I was selected for the Kenyan squad back in school days.
Right. To play where?
It was to go on a training. It was to then represent the country. But I actually then left to go to England to train for the nursing that didn't happen.
Yes, tying all the bits together.
Yes. Mm. So I never did play for Kenya. No.
Right. So again, the idea of keeping yourself active and all that. Would it be true to say that you still play tennis to this day, or have you given up because of stiff joints and creaky limbs? What's happening?
I still play. Mm. I still play every week if I can.
Right.
And really, only the ball boys are the ones who are honest enough to say, you don't play as well as you used to.
Right.
And I tell them they're cheeky devils.
Everybody else is being entirely complimentary.
Oh, yes. We're very polite to each other.
Right. One last question on this idea of social activity. Do you think that as a minority, again, speaking for the great mass of people, which is unfair, that you could do more? Because the idea is that the white Kenyan is lying low like an envelope, not to involve him or herself or himself in anything political, just to sort of be under the radar. Is this a subject to which you've given any thought? Are you visible or invisible?
Politically, completely invisible.
Hmm.
I would like to say I make a difference in the lives of people I'm with. Oh, John, that's a hard question.
I like asking hard questions.
Yeah, I've gathered that.
Yes. But that's a sufficient answer. You're not here to save the world. You're just there to respond to my probing questioning. And it's good enough time for us to take our last break. Thank you very much. Dada, last segment, last few questions. May I, if you would, turn to you? We talked about your people. Could you tell us something about your own personal contributions to the society at large and what lessons we might learn from your experience?
Well, currently, and for the last actually 20-something years, I've been very involved with a little pre-primary school in Dagoretti. It's for underprivileged children. It's a very exciting project. You know, primary school is free, slightly in inverted commas, because there are expenses. But pre-primary is not. And we watched children coming from desperate situations, thrown into a classroom of sometimes over 100 young people, and they have no background whatsoever in education. And for them to then survive in that environment is really hard. So we've started, and I love the we. Others have funded, and I've simply played my tiny part. But we've got, to date, 106 children in a little pre-primary school. We feed them physically. We try to educate them, and we do from the age of 3 till 6. And we spiritually nourish them and let them know how valuable and important they are. And that's been an amazing project, watching these little ones then have a springboard to go into primary school and then ultimately on from there.
So how long have you been doing that? You said, and I'm also quite keen on the we, expand on, because I'm seeing all these little ones, 100 and so many of them. How do you choose the ones we're going to get in? Because I could assume that there's slightly more than 106 needy 3 to 6 year olds. There's a selection process there of sorts.
There is a selection. They apply. Obviously, the mothers come. It's not the children who apply. And I say mothers because the majority are from single families, single mothers. We do a short list and actually visit their homes to see if, you know, how bad the circumstances are. And there are many, many desperate cases. because the children on the whole walk to school, because if they can afford the matatu, then they're probably not as destitute as those that we're taking in. So our catchment area is fairly small. They need to be able to walk in. We now get the mums to pay something towards the food that we give them, because we give them tea and mandazi when they first come, and then they get a nice lunch. And if the parents really cannot afford anything, then they'll come and do a little bit of cleaning in the school for us, something just to make, so they can take ownership of this.
Shall I'd like to point a finger at government. I'm wondering, because this is an initiative that you and friends have set up, would you deign to seek support from the government in any way? And do you think that it would give it in the form of land to expand, teachers to teach? Or is the government sort of saying, oh, there are a bunch of do-gooders out there, let them get on with it, and we'll sit back and watch?
It would be wonderful if the government would do it.
But they don't.
They don't.
So how did you acquire... Did you have to start off by acquiring the land upon which you've built the school?
Well, we started... It was a Kenyan friend of mine who approached me and said she really wanted to do this. So this is not my idea. This was her idea. And she saw a need... And we initially got permission to use the Red Cross building in Dagoretti. And she was able to set up and teach children there 3 times a week. But she had to pack it all up into a cupboard in the afternoon and then take it out again a couple of days later. A friend who worked here in Barclays Bank took an interest in this. And he and his wife and family got quite involved. And come Christmas time, he suggested to his fellow workers, rather than giving each other a bottle of something for Christmas, why not support this charity? Which I think they all very happily did. He was sent back to UK and continued to do this fundraising and contacted me a couple of years later saying, I think I've raised enough money to buy some land.
No.
So Jane, my Kenyan friend, I said to her, right, let's find land. And she found a wonderful plot. I went with her to look at it, and the price doubled.
Oh, because you were part
because
of the entourage.
I was a Muzungu.
Yes, yeah, right.
So we refused to spend donors' money on an inflated price. So
you shouldn't have gone. You should have known what the response might be.
So foolish. So foolish.
Okay.
So she went to look for another plot.
Right.
And I didn't.
And this time you didn't go.
I didn't set foot on it until the title deeds were
in black boot polish.
I should have tried it. I trusted her implicitly.
Right.
And we bought and she subsequently built. We built initially a ground floor with 3 classrooms. And an office and obviously all the ablutions and a kitchen. And we're able to, in 2012, we were able to go double story to put in more classrooms. So we are able to, we can probably go up a few numbers in the building that we've got now. And it's, well, it's just a wonderful spot. And it has led on to our offices being used by 2 other organisations who both help children to get into secondary school. Because we have the free primary, but we don't have free secondary. So some of our little children from the little kindergarten are now coming out at the top, and they're still in desperate circumstances, and we are able to carry them on into secondary school. So
again, yeah, it's weird, and I guess it's a question for us all. When you were saying, you know, steer clear of politics and everything else, how do you think you might be a part of making those who make great political promises to the electorate just before the elections more aware of the importance of education, do you think, or you just little coteries like your own are going to make all the difference?
If I'm honest, I think the only way I could do that is by talking to people who could influence politics. And indeed, recently I have been doing just that. But the news she gave me was that they were cutting the salaries of pre-primary school. And I thought, oh dear, this is desperate. But I know she's fighting their cause. So she is trying very hard.
So, we're running out of time, sadly. What is your a success story, a case study where you can say, you know, we've been doing this. I must tell you a little story that sort of encapsulates whatever is the fulfillment that you derive from this activity.
Well, the end of last year, one of the students coming out of the secondary school trust got a first class honours degree. And you just think that was a little girl living, I would say, in a cardboard house. It wasn't quite. But how incredible that she came through and is now flying high. I mean, it's just so exciting. And of course, it's not always like that. We've had some disasters, but when you have a success story like that, it just makes all the hard work very worthwhile.
Dada, the time has come for me to ask the question. Who are you?
John, I am Dee Huth. For those who would have known me at school, it would be Dorinda. But I'm only called that by people probably your age.
Or
my husband when he's cross with me.
Well, I must say you're the first Dorinda I've ever met, and I'm delighted that I have. You've made it clear in the course of our conversation that you've been quintessentially a homemaker. That's been activity number one, that you've dabbled in businesses and succeeded, that you've engaged in social activities, some for pleasure and some for good, and that you've been part of an initiative to educate young Kenyans. So, you know me and my nasty searching questions. The last question I'm going to ask you as a rep once again is, since June the 1st, 1963, do you think that race relations between white people, presumably our colonial masters, the South Asians who came in here as indentured labourers, following on by the Chinese brethren who were busy constructing buildings for us, and other activities, doubtless, and the black majority, are things getting better or worse? And if they could be made better, how? Again, seemingly, I know it's an impossible question, but have a go.
John, I think they're definitely getting better. I think just the lives we live, we interact so much more. My Kenyan friends give much better hugs than my European friends. I've got some wonderful Kenyan friends. And I think right across the board, it's just becoming natural. It's not a forced thing, which perhaps it was 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Right.
I think now friendships are genuine, deep friendships.
Right. That's good. I have to draw more on you because we've got to sort of play to the clock, and that the clock gives us another 3 minutes. So we're going to rinse this topic dry. And again, what could be done to make those relationships better? Let's go back to the Lenana School, Limuru days, where, in fact, by government decree, we were forced to have a partition of the races. So we had a third, I think it was the Gashadi report, a third of the school was South Asian, a third was black, and a third was white. So I can honestly say in my late 60s that I have friends across the board from my school days who are of all the kabilas in this country. But unfortunately, we've now got to a situation where people are operating in silos more and more. So do you think that we should force people to come together in a sort of busing type scenario? You know, like, you know.
I don't, because I don't think that works.
Oh, you don't believe that forcing people to come together, it probably did in the United States. They sort of got trucks and people and delivered the first African-American kid to a school with the people guarding them.
I don't think you can force relationships. I think they happen.
Okay.
And the Kenyans are such wonderful, friendly people.
Right.
I believe it's happening. Okay. I really do. I don't think you can force a relationship.
Okay. If that's your final word, it has to be your final word. It's 19 hours, 29 minutes and 44 seconds just passed, and time to stop. So do continue to give us feedback, hopefully positive and reassuring, on the Twitter handle at Capital FM Kenya, or drop us a text or WhatsApp message on 0701-984-984. I've been talking to Dee Huth, a proud Kenyan and homemaker who, significantly for today's edition, was witness to Madaraka Day in June 1963. And you've been listening to John Sibi Okumu on Wednesday. Thank you most kindly for doing that. Very much obliged. Happy Madaraka Day, y'all. Until next time.